Good afternoon, and welcome to spring. I don't know why it is so cold in here, but I assume since it's spring, they've turned the air conditioning on. There's a very cold draft. If I stand down there, I'm going to end up... Actually, it's warmer out there, so I'm going to probably test the sound system and see how far toward the heat I can get and still be heard. So that's my experiment for the day. How are you all?
Dandy.
Cold. Dandy. Cold and dandy. Okay. Good. Two announcements. Exercise or assignment 5 is due next week. And we have offered to read and respond to drafts if they come in by Friday. So if we have them by Friday, we'll be able to give... On Saturday. Speak for yourself. Okay. You may email them or deliver them along with a bag of truffles or something on Saturday. I'm not reading them this weekend, so Talia will do that. The reason I'm not is that I have to finish my income taxes, right? It says right on the calendar, February 15th, finish income taxes. So anyway, we'll do that this weekend. And Talia will read the drafts. And we do urge you to take advantage of that if at all possible, because it'll A, force you to do it before it's due, and B, give you some feedback, which if you follow it probably will improve the your performance on that assignment. Tiffany. Do we prefer an email or a paper copy? Paper is best, because then Talia can carry them around with her and read them in the bathroom and on the bus and walking to and from class. And in the middle of the night when she's sleepless... Okay. Right. They will put her to sleep. Okay. Probably not. Okay. Yes, paper copy would be preferable. If it turns out that that's completely unreasonable, if you email it by Friday, we can print them out on the printer. But try to give her a paper copy. You could even bring it to class on Wednesday. No, she's shaking her head frantically. No. Okay. Any questions about that process and assignment 5? No. Second announcement, I have repeatedly forgotten to tell you and managed to ignore it all weekend. I intended to put it on the website and did not. The Pierce reading, which you were supposed to have done last week, some people have had difficulty finding, probably the people who've gone to look for it, on electronic reserve, because the title is different than is on the bibliography and the syllabus. The title I gave you was Who's Raising Baby? The real title in the library is Challenges to Modern Day Parenting, the article by Pierce. So if you go look for it, you'll find it under Challenges to Modern Day Parenting. It turns out that the piece I have was published with a subtitle, and all I got was the subtitle. I didn't get the whole section thing. So, okay, other questions or issues or problems? Okay, we've got people, Brunson Brennerized. We have them dated, cohabited. Now we've got them married, and we're going to proceed to get them pregnant. No, I don't have a film of that. You have to use your imagination. We've got them fighting already. We've had that happen last week. And predicted their divorce or not. And now it's time to look at the biggest challenge that most of the people who participate in families will ever have. Parenting. Or being parented. Both of which can be challenging. And for that, I'm going to turn to the Galinsky book, and talk about what she is trying to do and why we're reading it, and then I'm going to elaborate on some of the themes in the Galinsky book. What Galinsky is doing is looking at what parenting is all about. And for that, as she describes in the introduction, she interviewed a variety of people. Ellen Galinsky is a researcher and consultant on child development and daycare, and works, I believe, now still in the Center for Work and Family, and is interested in how people balance work and family, and studying the issues involved for parents, and the difficulties of childcare. So she has a number of publications. If you Google her, or do a search through the social science databases, you'll come up with a number of articles and publications by her. When she started working on parenthood, she was interested in how parents view it and what they see the challenges to be, and that was what resulted in this particular book. And as you'll notice through the book, she has excerpts from her interviews, so you get the flavor of how parents talk about the process of parenthood. And then she has reviewed relevant literature and included that to provide the research underpinning and the conceptual base for what she feels the parents are going through. It is a constructive view, as she's talking about the issues for parents constantly changing as parents make sense out of their experience and as they develop the skills and the motivation to do the job in the way that they discover it needs to be done, which may be quite different from the way they thought it was going to be done. In the book, she relies on the notion that we have images. And these are, I think, from our perspective, they are your understanding of the world that you live in. They are a view of yourself and the world, your ecosystem, as you participate in it. And what she's done through the book is to go from the images that people come into the process of parenting with, which they've accumulated all of their lives from being parented, and then they solidify that through the pregnancy, because now they're thinking about parenthood with this particular partner, if they have one, and with the child that will result from this particular pregnancy at this point in their lives, in this ecosystem which they now inhabit. So what they thought parenting might be like when they were 5 or 8 or 12 or 14 is now placed in a much more specific context of the relationship and the microsystem as they are experiencing it, and the reality of the pregnancy. What they're doing is revising and refining the image, their view of the world, that part of it, that part of their world, which is going to be involved with parenting. And then through the book, she describes the process of parents continually changing that image to fit the realities of the growing and changing child that they are encountering. Because children don't come into the world fully formed. They come in rather lumpy looking and ill-defined and not very talented, and it's hard to tell what they'll be like when they're 17 or 25 when they're born. And they keep changing. So the parent is constantly changing the image of what this child is and their image of themselves as parents to accommodate the experience that they're having with this specific child, who may be quite different from any child that they thought they would ever have. So the book is about your view of the process of parenting and what the experience requires of you. And as she goes through that, she didn't start off with this notion, but she realized as she was doing the research and as parents were describing it, that parents are constantly changing and the driving force is the child. So the parent is constantly confronting a changing child because children develop. And as children go through their development and have new skills, they make different demands on the parent. They present different challenges to the parent. And they change the task of parenting. Parenting an infant is not the same as parenting a six-year-old who's going to school, is not the same as parenting a pubescent child, is not the same as parenting your 19-year-old going off to college. Okay. So what she did was look at the challenges that are changed by the changing child. And by implication suggests that we're going through stages of parenting, but those stages are defined by the child, not by the parent. It's the child that is driving the transaction between the parent and child. Okay. So the kids are in charge. There's an interesting notion. And it's a constructive, transactional view that she's describing. And it's consistent with Bronfenbrenner's notion that he presents in Proposition C, that when one person goes through a developmental change, one person in the dyad, the other person is likely to as well. And it's those developmental transitions that she's describing, as parents are shoved into the next stage by the child who is no longer behaving like the child they were engaged with in the previous stage. And my experience as a parent was pretty consistent with that. I found I did really well for a while. There were plateaus. And I would get used to one of the kids, and we'd have a pretty good relationship worked out. The transaction would be smooth, and everything would go along fairly well for a little while. And then we would start having problems. And it usually I'm slow, so it usually took me a while to figure out that we were having problems and things weren't going as smoothly as they were, and then we'd have some blow up. And when I would sit down and do a postmortem on that blow up, I would realize that, I got it. The kid has changed. It's not that I'm dumb, it's just that I'm not keeping up with the kid. And the kids would not announce that they were changing. They would just change. They would just start doing things differently. They would change what they were interested in. They would change their responses. They would change their potential and have new skills. And I would go along in the old comfortable way in the dyad. And then it wouldn't work. And it didn't work because the transaction, as I was participating in it, was not congruent with what the child needed as the child had changed. So I was constantly being thrown into the next stage by one child or the other to keep up. So I can feel very deep in my gut what Galinsky is talking about with the child driving the changes in parenting, because each time the child developed a new skill, a new approach, a new involvement in the world, it brought to his or her parents the challenges of changing so that we were now being able to facilitate what was going on without frustrating the child or us. Okay. So what Galinsky refers to as the episodic developmental change. Kids don't change smoothly. They change fairly quickly. They change sometimes very subtly. They don't tell you. And then there's the change and you're trying to scramble. Now, Galinsky says it on page 48. One of the challenges in the book is, how does one stage lead into the next? That's a question for all developmental theories. It's fairly easy, and you'll find dozens of wonderful developmental theories that will describe stages in development. And that's what stage theories do. Not all theories of development are stage theories, but some of the biggies are. Freud, Erikson, Sullivan, Piaget, whole bunches of them, Vygotsky. They have stages. And it's fairly easy, not really a big intellectual challenge, to define the stages. The challenge for developmental theorists is to explain the changes. How do you get from one stage to the next? Okay. And that's where many of the more robust theories still fall down, because they don't explain how you make the change from one stage to the next. Galinsky says, in this case, it's fairly easy to explain the parent's change. The child has changed, and that shoves the parent into the next stage. So she starts the book with the image-making stage, prenatal, and the birth of the child is a pretty obvious, abrupt, and sudden, hopefully, change. And here you are, now you have this creature. And it moves you into the nurturing stage with its challenges. So let's look, before we go into the nurturing stage, at what happens with the couple. Here you are, you're a couple, maybe just for a night, maybe for 10 years, and somewhere in between. And you get pregnant. Maybe it's planned. Maybe it's cost you a lot of money to get pregnant. Maybe you've worked at it with a great deal of difficulty. And there you are. And maybe it hasn't. Maybe it just happened. But there you are. You're pregnant. And now you have to deal with that. So both parents activate the images that they have developed over their lives, because now we have the reality of the pregnancy. My weekend entertainment Friday night was watching the video of Meet the Fockers, which probably many of you have seen. They're very funny. I really enjoyed it. And partly because my best friend works for the CIA, so that I can imagine him in retirement building the RV with the secret panels underneath and the communication system. But there's the couple. They're not yet married, but she discovers that they're pregnant. And now she has to deal with that, and they're happy to be pregnant, but they have to deal with everybody else's response to the pregnancy. And in one case, his parents are very happy and thrilled, and her parents are obviously, at least in their image, going to be terribly upset by this. And now they have to change the wedding date, and that's, if you've seen it, you can imagine the difficulty of coming to terms very suddenly with the awareness of the pregnancy before you're married. The weekend that they were planning to plan the wedding for the fall, and now it's going to be an immediate wedding. Okay, so you have the pregnancy happening, and both parents have to start adapting to the fact that we are now pregnant. And we're going to think about what we thought that would be like. And it's fascinating to watch newly pregnant people begin to face the reality if they have not had very clear images, and if their images, as most of us have images that if we're going to go into something, our images are fairly positive. So we have the pictures of the woman who's 7 months pregnant, and she has a glow about her, and she's wearing nice maternity clothes, and everybody pats her tummy and asks what it's going to be. You have to get used to that role, having people pat your tummy. Strangers in the supermarket, they come up, they pat your tummy. They seem, in our culture, and in other, at least the ones I'm familiar with in Western Europe, people feel entitled to join you in celebrating your pregnancy and pat your tummy and urge you to get off your feet, put your feet up. They start giving you advice about the health stuff. And that's very nice. But the sixth or seventh month is preceded by the second and third month, which are a little more difficult because you may not show and you feel like, well, you're eating crackers if you're eating anything, and water and ginger ale a little bit, because you have morning sickness. And for some people, that's a significant problem. And morning sickness in some cases starts at some ungodly hour of the morning, like 2 o'clock in the morning, and you wake up and you're completely nauseated, and what you really want is a lot of sympathy and comfort and perhaps an apology from the person in bed with you who was, after all, responsible for this pregnancy in most cases. So the images that we have typically do not involve the negative stuff that comes along with pregnancy. The images also may not include the ninth month in July, when all you want is out of this, please. It's 95 degrees, it's humid, I can't move, I feel, blah. I just want out of this, and I want this baby to be a month premature, please. No. It's not really something you want to wish for, but it's often spoken as a hope by people who are suffering through the very last weeks of a pregnancy. So you have all of those changes in the image. And people are typically having some doubt. They're also changing their setting. Or they feel like they ought to change their setting, but maybe they're not. Maybe the setting needs to be changed because it will not accommodate a baby. So what are we going to do with the baby? We've got to turn your home office into a nursery. We have to go to yard sales and collect baby equipment and furniture. Okay. So we have to begin to change the setting and its physical characteristics, its literally its furnishings, and sometimes the color of the walls and the ceilings, and buy the mobiles and make those nice Martha Stewart nursery sorts of things around the ceiling. What are they called? Borders? Maybe we're going to stencil the walls. And the wonderful ideas that people often have, and then you discover by the time you get to them, there's no way you can be up on the ladder, so it's going to be his job to be up on the ladder, and he didn't sign in for the week. Wait, we're having a baby. Why do we have to redecorate the house? Okay, so his image of being a father didn't include standing on a stepladder, stenciling the border for Martha Stewart around the top, but they have to agree. So there are all kinds of issues with each person, and with their transaction as they work to develop an image that is shared and compatible. That's the point at which you start getting really serious about some of the topics that you didn't talk about when you were courting. Okay, what was it like in your family? How do you want to be a parent who's different from the parents that you have? You start watching other parents of infants very closely, and you begin criticizing them. So suddenly, you're seeing that, well, they're not maybe doing it the way we want to do it. So you're constructing an image about what this infant is going to be like and what you're going to be like as parents. And that can be a challenge for the couple if they have different images of what the other is supposed to do during the infant stage of parenting. So couples sometimes have conflict, negative affect, because they're not agreeing on what his role is going to be and what her role is going to be. And they may never have talked about that before. They may never have thought much about it, but now they have to. What else happens? Your mesosystem changes. The mesosystem changes because now you have prenatal care. Now you have doctor's appointments. You may have to start thinking about things like, oh, we don't have a will, do we? Huh. What would happen if... And for many couples, the pregnancy, as we've mentioned before, means that now they're going to get married. So they need to do that. And that changes their mesosystem and changes their relationships with the potential grandparents who may be thrilled or may not if the potential grandparents aren't particularly supportive of this relationship or they think, well, it's about time or it's much too early or how do you think you can afford to raise a baby? You're not ready to raise a baby. So you have some potential conflict in other dyadic relationships that may affect the mesosystem. You may find that there's so much excitement among friends and relatives in that mesosystem that the communication becomes much more constant. They may have been quite willing to leave you on your own as long as it was just the two of you, but now that you're pregnant, they're going to call every day and see how you're feeling. Are you showing yet? How do you feel? Here's my cure for morning sickness. Here's my cure for morning sickness. You should see my doctor because my doctor is really great and I'm sure your doctor isn't nearly as great. You get all kinds of advice again from parents and friends and relatives, grandparents. Everybody's going to give you advice. They're going to have a new interest in what's going on in your setting and in your relationship. So there's more communication, there's more desire for intersetting knowledge in the mesosystem. You're also experiencing the macrosystem in a new way. Every macrosystem has a view of parenthood. Every macrosystem has notions about what people who are about to be parents should be doing, could be doing, ought to be doing, and how to treat them. So you discover as soon as, and it's gotten worse recently, as soon as anybody identifies you as a pregnant person, the nature of the spam on your email is going to change because you get on lists. And every spammer who has anything to sell to new parents will be there and they will start trying to sell you, as soon as you're identified as a pregnant couple, they will try to sell you kits for making your infant a genius, offers to help you make the more money that you're going to need because you will now be raising another person and trying to feed that person. The baby food companies will get you, the baby furniture companies, the diaper rental place. Do they still exist? You used to be able to rent cloth diapers. Do they still do that? Or did Pampers just put them out of business?
A lot more,
okay. Because you don't want to wash all those diapers. But you want cloth diapers because they don't go in the landfill. So you rent your diapers. You get a whole bunch of ads from them. Your junk mail changes in the same way. In our macro system, in other macro systems, they don't. That's not likely to happen. But in ours, it's... The potential to make money from you as a new parent is very important in capitalism. It's part of our system. They are welcoming the new consumer into the market. And they want to sign up your baby as a consumer as quickly as possible. So the macro system is going to change, and your place in it is going to change very quickly. Other changes that you are familiar with or have thought about while you were reading Galinsky or watching your friends deal with pregnancy?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. One of the issues clearly is that our images of the baby that we're going to have almost never include Down syndrome or any chromosomal defect or any difficulty in the pregnancy. So most of us just simply don't go into the pregnancy expecting to have a child with problems. The process of losing a child before birth, that process is also not part of the image. The first time, the first pregnancy, most of us don't expect to lose a pregnancy. And it's a fascinating process when it happens, because what you're feeling is the loss of that positive image that you had. Even if they tell you that the baby would not have survived, it had multiple problems, it wasn't going to survive. Even if they tell you that, the image that you carry, even through the loss, is typically the Gerber baby. The Gerber baby, that beautiful kid, or whatever is culturally or ethnically, racially appropriate for you, that's the baby that you're expecting to have. And that's the baby that you lose, because it wasn't born. And it's fascinating to watch how people respond to that. Because in our society, at least, it's fairly rare for a couple to experience permission to experience the full grief of loss. What happens after a child is born and an infant dies is people will give you most of the permission to have a full grieving period, and they will respond to you as well as they can. In our society, we don't deal with grief generally very well. But before birth, if you lose a pregnancy, it's much harder for people to give you that permission and to acknowledge the reality of what has happened, especially if it happens fairly early. So the first time some people will know that you're pregnant is when your pregnancy ends, tragically. And it's not unusual for people to respond to that not very helpfully. Oh, well, you can have another one, just you should get pregnant right away, which may not be what the physician is suggesting. Get pregnant right away may not be the right thing for your body. They may need to figure out what was going on before you risk having another loss, and especially for some people, 2 or 3 or 4 miscarriages or stillbirths are not uncommon. They do a job on your emotional state, unfortunately, but they're not uncommon. Sometimes, if the pregnancy was not really welcome and welcomed in the extended family, people are even denied the opportunity to grieve, because people will say, oh, well, now you can go on with your life. You don't have to figure out what you're going to do with this baby. That happened for me a number of years ago with a student who got pregnant and took time off, decided she was going to have the baby and raise it. And the pregnancy ended about 6 months in, and her mother's immediate response was, "Oh, what a relief." And she was denied the opportunity to grieve, which affected her for a number of months, and until she finally got in a situation where somebody who had better sense said, "Wow, did anybody cry with you?" And she proceeded to cry for an hour. And then they had the grieving process went on in its normal way, but it had been postponed because the pregnancy was not welcome in the extended family. So it's difficult when you lose a pregnancy. It's still difficult when you have a baby that doesn't survive very long. But people are likely, the longer the child lives, the more likely people are to let you have the full grief experience. So there's a problem in the way we deal with pregnancy and infancy. Right.
In the hospital. And because she had myself and my older sister, so well, thank God you have the girls, because
right.
We didn't know what to do if it was.
Yeah. And all of those responses are minimizing the loss and helping the people who are saying them, helping them avoid dealing with it, but they're not helpful to the parent and other family members who have lost this pregnancy or this infant. And it's interesting to analyze those because it says, unless the child enters your setting, it's not yet really important. So if the kid's in the hospital in the intensive care nursery for 6 months before it dies, you didn't take it home, so it's not really official. Right, through the whole pregnancy. Exactly. Exactly. Thank you for that. If it has been in your setting, it's been in your body until that point when you lose it. And that's what Galinsky helps us understand, that what this image is not just a picture on the wall. This image is your view of the world. I like Bronfenbrenner's phrase, rather than just thinking of it as an image. It's your understanding of the child, the potential child, of yourself as a parent. You're developing the dyadic relationship with this pregnancy, with this potential child, all the way through that process. And it's important to honor that if that process ends prematurely. And that, thank you for pointing that out. Because the child has been in your setting. But when you look at what people say, they're stretching, they're grasping, they're trying to make it less important so that you won't have to grieve so hard and they won't have to figure out how to deal with that, because many of us have a lot of difficulty dealing with people's grief. Okay, what else happens as you're developing and refining this image through pregnancy? Other things that you've experienced or you've watched? Yeah. Wow.
Doctors like, "Oh, you're having birth right now," so it's like the immediate change in their symptoms, like went to overnight
where they were before. But wonderful failure to be able to, she didn't have the opportunity to develop the image because she didn't know she was pregnant for that period of time. So that's the abrupt one. And there are other situations in which that, no image, and here's the baby, happen. I can think of two situations that I've been through with friends. One was a fellow graduate student, a little older, when I was in graduate school. She and her husband had come back to graduate school. They were considerably older, and they had been married a long time, and they had applied to adopt a child. And it dragged on and on and on for years. They didn't get a child to adopt. And they had planned a backwoods roughing it camping experience one summer in the North Woods of Minnesota. And they had designed their whole summer around that experience. And 2 days before they were to leave, they got a call from the adoption agency saying, "Your baby was just born. And you can come and get it in 3 days. You can come see it now if you want." So here they were, this three-week backwoods backpacking experience, all set up, no other preparation for having an infant, a newborn. There it was. Here's the newborn. They went camping anyway because the doctor said, "Healthy baby, you're not going to nurse anyway, so here's a month's supply of formula. Just here's what you need to lay in. Make sure that you know the road out in case anything happens, but it's not likely to with a healthy baby." So they went camping and had a great time. My sister-in-law did that too, and my brother. They went camping in Europe with I think she was 6 months old. Six weeks old. Okay, so they did it. The other one that was more tragic was friends who had I think it was his sister was pregnant, and they had the baby, and the mother died shortly after delivery. She had a serious bleeding complication, and during the treatment had a stroke and died. The baby was about 3 days old, and the husband just simply could not deal. He couldn't deal with the loss, and he couldn't figure out what to do with the baby. So he asked my friend and his wife to take the baby for him. And they ended up, they have raised the child. He never really got it back together. And they were happy to have the child. They already had two. And so they just brought this unanticipated baby into their household. But they'd been through it before, so it was a little bit different because they had images. It was just an unexpected experience, especially since I think it was his sister who died. Unanticipated. Other things that might happen during that period?
So if you want to adopt a child and you go waiting for 9 months to meet the mom, and at the end the mom turns out she doesn't want to give it up for adoption.
Yeah, that's a different kind of loss of the image. With open adoptions now, people are much more likely to have that opportunity. People that I knew here wanted to adopt the mom and the baby, and they were going to really take over the mom and support her before the delivery and after, and have a very open adoption. And after the baby was born, mom decided she didn't want to do that. So they had built up their image, and then it was gone. Yeah, alcohol and embryology don't mix very well while the brain is being formed, beginning. First 2 months particularly, but people are usually more aware by the time they get to the second month, but the first month is a real difficult time if you don't know you're pregnant. Okay, well then what happens? Then the baby comes. And as the baby comes, there you are. You have this change in setting, change in role. You're really parents now. And you enter what Galinsky calls the nurturing stage. And as you do that, you're faced with the reality, which may be quite different from the image that you've developed. You have to create a real dyadic relationship with this infant who no longer is in utero, but is there, and it's there 24/7. It's in there in the middle of the night. It's there when you're trying to do other things, and you couldn't hear it very well when it was in utero. You couldn't hear it at all. And now you can hear it a lot. Every 3 hours. We're watching, some of you know, one of our child care providers, mentor, teacher, who said that last week wasn't too bad. He had a pretty good night's sleep one night, and he got some the other nights, and I suggested that, you know, probably just hope for an average of 4, maybe 5 hours a night, you'll be just fine. And that's about what they're getting as they deal with this new baby. Galinsky says the major task of this stage is to form an attachment to the baby. And that means adjusting, accommodating the image that you've formed with the reality. You know how cute that Gerber baby is. Remind me to do an overhead with the Gerber baby one of these years. That's not what newborns look like. How many of you have seen a newborn first day? Okay. What do they look like? Ugly. Right. If they're vaginal deliveries, their heads are shaped like footballs. They're pointed. They look like cone heads. They're wrinkly. The vernix caseosa has dried, so it's flaky. And now you're going to have to rub that off. The extremities are blue. It's not pretty. It's not the Gerber baby. The one thing we picked up in Meet the Fockers was they had this newborn at some point, and it was clearly not a newborn. It was several months old, and they tried to pass it off. It was just bad editing. They should have had a real newborn, for those of us who know the difference. And then you get to try to form a dyadic relationship with this new person. That's what parents are supposed to do. So here's this new person. It doesn't talk. It eats, and it poops, and it keeps you awake. It has several functions. You can push the buttons, and here come the functions. But it's pretty random for many of them. And you get to figure out how to relate to it, how to calm it, how to soothe it, how to engage in a joint activity with it. Mutual gazing, that's a good joint activity. Lots of eye contact, lots of cuddling, lots of molding. You're creating the beginning of joint activities, but they're fairly simplistic joint activities. And you want to like it. You'd really like to feel positive toward it. That might happen. Forming an attachment is developing a relationship that has positive affect, that has enough reciprocity so that you know that you're communicating with each other. Brazelton and others refer to the synchrony of the interaction as being important. And there are wonderful old movies of parents and children engaging in synchronized vocal behavior and motor behavior with each other. That's part of the process of developing the attachment. If you learn to call and respond to engage in a dance, it makes you feel like you are relating, and you begin to get positive. Some kids don't do that very well. Some kids don't do that very much, and some parents don't do it very well. And that is a problem with the attachment process. So they're trying to create a dyad that's comfortable as the foundation for the attachment, and parents are more or less successful at that, depending on their histories, their characteristics, their sensitivity, and the infant that they get. They're also dealing with the fact that this child may have problems. It may not be the robust, healthy, perfect baby that everybody expects to have. So it may need special care. It may be in intensive care for a while. It's a very alien environment. How many of you have spent some time in the intensive care nursery? Fascinating place. Noisy, bright, just wonderful place if you're into high-tech gadgetry and people rushing around a lot. But it's not a place that's comfortable for parents. They try to make it comfortable for parents, but most of us don't want to be there. And we're anxious when we're there. And they try to make the setting comfortable for us so that we can focus on the baby. They do a pretty good job in some hospitals, this one particularly. But it may not be the kind of place you were expecting to be while you're trying to create a relationship with your baby. One of the other issues is that as you're dealing with any baby, it is going to interfere with sleep, it is going to be a distraction, and people who are used to regular hours, going to work, spending long hours at work, playing, whatever it is that they do, have begun to adjust that through the pregnancy. But for the father particularly, the pregnancy may not have had a major impact on his involvement in the mesosystem or the predictability of his activities. When the reality hits, people are often scrambling to create good relationships with the mesosystem that they now have some stress about, because there are demands typically for being at home. There may be demands for being in the hospital. There may be demands for helping to care for the mother, who may be having complications after the delivery, and fitting that into your high-powered job may not be very easy. So the mesosystem may become a source of conflict because of the increased activities and the changed role that you have at home within that relationship. I used to give a lecture called How to Destroy a Perfectly Good Relationship. I rarely give it anymore, but the gist of it was, you've got this couple, and they're happy with each other. They've got that stuff all worked out. And they're not mother and father yet. They're husband and wife. And they've been working on that relationship, and it's just the two of them, and the daily activities may be fairly flexible and predictable, and they may have a great relationship going. And then they add the infant, and the relationship that they have developed gets tested. And it may change very dramatically. They both will focus, typically, on the new dyadic relationship and temporarily diminish the importance of the husband-wife relationship. And if that continues, I mean, it's understandable for a while, but if it continues, as it does in many couples, the affect in the couple relationship begins to get negative and there may be more conflict. One of the difficulties is that they may not have figured out how to combine the roles. They now have role overload. You've got to figure out how to make these two different roles within the same setting compatible. Because you've added one. You may have had before a worker role, employee role, and one of the things that typically happens is that one person drops that role or changes it, try to find infant child care in Burlington, and the other one doesn't, so they are suffering from now an inequality, and they've changed the balance in their relationship because they're focusing on different things. As if the mother stays home, she's focusing on the mother role, which focuses her on the infant. Father has not reduced his roles, he's increased his roles, and they're going to be unequal, typically, in their ability to, and their opportunity to focus on the infant parent role. They're both engaged in an infant parent role, but it may be unequal. She's there. If you want to test that one, just suggest that you keep your job when your baby is born, if you're the woman. You keep your job, your husband stay home. He takes 6 months off. Sweden, Scandinavia, other countries do that. They give both parents time, although it's not equal time. The Swedish legislature was considering, I don't know what they did with it, but they were going to make it mandatory that fathers take part of the parental leave when a child is born. Because now it's optional and most men don't take it. The women take it. And they were going to reserve something like 6 months of it and say that has to be taken by the father or you lose it. You don't have that leave unless it's taken by father. It'll be interesting. I don't know what they did with that one. But it was an interesting proposal. And it addresses the fact that fathers were keeping the worker role while the mothers were reducing the worker role to focus on the mother role. So there's an imbalance in most couples if one of them is doing more of the worker and the other is doing less, which allows one of them to focus on the parental role more than the other. So they're not taking the complementary roles equally. Eventually, that leads to conflict in the husband-wife role as they try to balance who are you really interested in. A personal story, when our daughter was born, I, being, of course, a child psychologist, was kind of interested in this whole process, especially since I was teaching infancy, a seminar, so I was quite interested in our daughter. And I assumed correctly that my wife wanted me to be fully involved and valued my appreciation for the delivery and all of that. But there was a point at which, after I had come home, I was coming home earlier than I normally did. I would come home and I would run up the stairs and check in with Gwen, our daughter. And then after a little while of having fun with baby, I would come down and say hi to my wife. You can guess what's coming. The day I came home, and I did that, and came down, and my wife was in tears in the kitchen. It had just come to a head for her that I was more interested in the baby than her at that point. And she had spent the whole day at home with a baby that was, you know, doing what babies do, which at that point wasn't very much. And my focus on my father role was interfering with my husband role, and Kit was upset about that, appropriately so. So we worked out a deal that I could perhaps curb my enthusiasm about Gwen and running up to see her. She was always upstairs in bed by the time I got home in the late afternoon, early evening. And perhaps I could curb that and remember that I was married and that my wife had been home all day, and I could come in the door, find her, say hi, maybe a hug. You know. Then I could run up the stairs and see Gwen, and it would be better if she didn't feel totally neglected, having looked forward to my coming home for the last hour and listened for the car, and there I was, and totally ignoring her. I got it. No, I'm not completely an idiot. I'm, you know, partly, but I wasn't a complete idiot, so I figured that out, that it wouldn't hurt my father role to delay enjoying that dyadic relationship and maybe work on this one a bit. For a lot of reasons, the husband-wife role is at risk when a baby is born. And that's one set of difficulties, trying to figure out what the roles are and which of them are going to be foremost, and the resulting imbalance for most of us in how we carry out the roles and which ones we're responsible for. Add to that reduced income and increased expenses. The profit margin is reduced, and often couples find themselves in debt or not able to do things that they wish they were able to do. And money is the root of a lot of marital difficulties, as you know. So that leads to conflict. And if people are not thinking about it, that conflict can get in the way of the husband-wife relationship. And as that becomes more negative, then there's more focus on the infant and the dyadic relationship with the infant, which takes more energy away from the husband-wife relationship. And as that happens, this relationship becomes less reciprocal, the affect becomes negative, and couples find themselves at each other's throats. And now they're blaming each other. He's blaming her for spending all of her energy on the infant. She's blaming him for, what, not being a good enough provider, not being a good enough husband, and not spending enough time with the baby. He gets all six barrels. And their relationship begins to go to hell. And that's the typical case. That's just typical. You just expect that to happen. I don't get any commission from zero population growth for telling you about that. It's just what all of the books about maintaining your relationship while you become parents will tell you. That's what you can expect, and it's for perfectly valid reasons, and Bronfenbrenner would let you describe the whole thing. Your roles have changed. Your mesosystem connections have changed. She's at home all the time. That looked like a good time for a while, but you miss your work friends, you miss all that validation you get out there, which is for you, not for the baby. When you work, you get validation for you. When you're a parent, it's all about the baby. So you destroy the relationship, unless you're aware of what's happening. And the easy solution is to recognize that when you have this baby, its primary task in life is to destroy your relationship. And everything that happens between you that is negative is the baby's fault. It's the responsibility of the baby. Once you recognize that, which is not acceptable in our macro system to actually say out loud publicly, that this baby is causing all these problems. You can't really blame the baby. It didn't ask to be born, and there it is. And it didn't ask for you to not be rich and be able to, you know, both of you take time off. It's not intentional on the baby's fault, on the baby's part. And it's not something that justifies abusing the baby. But it is something that is helpful to recognize, because you can build as part of your image before the baby is born and try to maintain after the baby is born. Focus on the importance of this relationship. And that means dropping other stuff. It means not blaming each other. It means not questioning the decision to have the baby. It means before the baby is born, making commitments to preserve your marriage while you deal with this incredibly challenging joint molar activity. It means validating each other every day. It means focusing on each other as husband-wife rather than just as new mom, new dad. So it's keeping the relationship between you paramount, because that's the one you want to last the rest of your life. You don't have to worry about the child, the parent-child relationship lasting the rest of your life. That will happen in some fashion. You don't divorce your kids. But the beginning of divorce for many couples is when they stop paying attention to those roles when they have the new baby. But it's very important to keep that in mind and to recognize that it won't happen automatically, and there will be many factors in the ecosystem that will conspire to reduce the importance of that relationship precisely at the time when you want it to be strengthened, but you're facing challenges in doing that. So it's important. And if you understand that that's what's going to happen, you can be prepared for it. Having a child with special needs makes that more difficult, because makes the whole adaptation more difficult. Part of what you're doing is, now that you've got this new addition, you now have three dyads instead of one. That's triple. It's a much more complex microsystem, and you've added roles to it, and the pattern of activities is now going to be focused on the infant who can't do for him or herself. It's your job as parents to teach the child over many, many years the activities and the skills, the view of the world that are going to help the child be able to take care of itself eventually and contribute to the microsystem. In the meantime, that microsystem pattern is going to be driven by what the infant needs, when it sleeps, when it needs to feed, when it poops. All of that stuff now becomes part of what is a much more complex microsystem pattern. What happens in whether it's a single parent or an experienced couple, when the baby spends a good deal of time in the intensive care nursery in the hospital, it becomes the most important setting in the mesosystem. And one of the issues that the pediatrics department in any hospital has to deal with is that they are one setting in the parent's ecosystem. And if they're sensitive to that, they will make sure that the parents have access to all of the support that is necessary for them to develop a long-distance relationship, because the infant is here. And you want the parent to be there as much as possible, but just think about the ecosystem that the parent is in and how complicated that may be by trying to take time off from work for one or both parents. Maybe not being able to do that. It helps if you have lots of money, lots of extended family, lots of friends, a good car, and if you happen to live within 5 miles of the hospital where your baby is transported. But if you're in upstate New York, which is one of the areas from which infants are transported to Fletcher Allen, so what do you do? What do you do with the other two kids at home? What do you do with your job? Where do you stay? How do you afford that? How do you create for yourself a setting and a set of mesosystem connections that work so that you can create a relationship with this baby?
What?
That's one of the areas. Upstate New York is one of the areas from which infants are transported. When you see the helicopter come in, it's off in the New York helicopter. The blue one is a helicopter from, I don't know, anyway, it's a medical transport helicopter from New York, the blue and yellow one, which brings patients here, and those patients are often coming to the intensive care nursery. I'm sorry? Ronald McDonald House is a great place to stay, but if you've got two kids in upstate New York or in elementary school or daycare, and that's the issue that is actually discussed in the text in Galinsky, because Klaus and Kennel describe the difficulties of creating an attachment when the infant is in intensive care. And when you have a child with special needs, particularly if those special needs are going to require physical care, medical care, then part of what you have to do as a parent is learn those skills, develop those activities. They change the role of parent. They make it much more demanding than you would otherwise have if you had the perfect Gerber baby. And you have to develop those skills, and then when you take the baby home, you have to incorporate those into your pattern, and your mesosystem may explode with new settings. You may have weekly checkups, you may have several different professionals who come into the house or to whom you have to go for medical and developmental care for the baby. And people who have a kid with special needs have a tremendous change in the complexity and the potential conflict in their ecosystem. Some of you have heard me talk about my youngest sister, who was born apparently normal but had a chromosomal defect, so that she did not develop, but she lived to be 7. And watching in our household the changes that took place as she continued to grow in size but not developmentally, watching the household accommodate that was a fascinating part of my childhood and adolescence. But one of the things that was very clear was that it increased the complexity of the mesosystem because of the medical consultation and frustration that happened through those years of not knowing what the issue was. Until she died. And at that point, on that happy note, we'll see you Wednesday.